Okay, shall we begin? Shall we begin? So last time we were talking about climate and the effect of physical considerations having to do with the sun and with thermal issues and how they shaped buildings. I ask at the end of that for you in your Twitter card question to give me responses about buildings or places you might know that seem to have their character largely or significantly derived from thermal issues and how they were dealt with in those instances. So I have some really good ones to share with you. Someone says, my childhood bedroom was always hot. We thought maybe it was because the room was at the end of the AC duct. However, I now realize that my bed was aligned with a large west-facing window, and the area was always heated, particularly during the summertime. Aha. You know, just understanding that in the planning of a house, what a huge difference that can make. Someone else says, I work in a lab in the Chemical and Molecular Science Building off Dean Keaton. It has this awesome, perfectly shaded patio, all made out of stone so that it's always cold to touch because it is rarely hit by the sunlight. Working there during the summer, I took advantage of this refreshing effect. Someone else says, my home in San Antonio employed a water system that uses solar radiation as a means of heating the water in the summer months. There are large water reserves in the attic that warm and store the water during the day so that it can be used at a later time. We obviously have a water heater, but this reduces the cost of the energy bill considerably. Solar hot water heating is super, super efficient. You basically just let the sun heat the water. Usually there's some kind of panel. The water runs through tubes or pipes. The sun shines on those tubes or pipes. The sun just heats it up, and then it stores in a reservoir. And you can even supplement it with additional heat. But already your water starts much warmer, and you don't have to get it from, 50 degrees to 110 degrees. You may just go from 80 degrees to 110 degrees and save yourself a lot of energy. When I lived in Australia many, many, many years ago, this was back in the early 80s, and on virtually every house, when you just looked across a subdivision in Australia, you would see a solar hot water heater on the roof of pretty much every house. Came back to Texas, where we have exactly the same climate. There was not one solar hot water heater I ever saw on any house in Austin, Texas at that time. Here we are 30 years later. We haven't really changed much. We still don't have solar hot water heating. In Australia, they have it constantly for the last 30 years. Why? I don't know. This person, however, his parents are smart. They have solar hot water heating. Someone else says, my grandmother's house is at the bottom of a hill and also has a protective porch that wraps around the front of it. There is a carport which shades what is not protected by the porch. The porch keeps my grandmother warm in the winter by allowing sun into the house and cool in the summer by blocking it. Someone else says, I know of a building that does a bad job of responding to climate, a barn that I built. The long sides face east and west. The pens where the cattle are worked on face the west side. The hot Texas sun beats us and the cattle down starting at 10 a.m. Also, the hot sun beams off the tin walls on every side. Lesson learned. Someone else says, my grandparents' house has big windows facing the south. However, there are trees in front of the windows. In the summer, these trees are full of leaves, so it keeps things cool. But in the winter, there are no leaves, so the sun is taken full advantage of in heating the house. Perfect solar shading, deciduous trees. They have leaves in the summertime when you want them to be shady. They lose their leaves in the wintertime when you want the heat. Perfect. Someone else says, there was a time when my family lived off the grid. Following a massive hurricane, our neighborhood was left without power in the midst of summer. We learned to utilize the house's windows and blinds to allow light and air in during the day without too much heat. We also restructured our sleep schedule to fit the day's light cycles. So just accustoming yourself to different patterns of living, as well as different physical facilities in response to climate. So I am totally on to this notion of if we just understood how our buildings operate, we could save a heck of a lot of energy. We could certainly design much better buildings, much more tuned to the climate. But why is it that in Australia, this has been a huge issue for decades? Ever since the energy crisis in the early 1970s, it's transformed the way they build and the way they live. In America, not so much. Why are we so resistant to this very economical, very practical set of issues? So I want you to be thinking deeply about this. And we're going to have some questions in a minute on it, too. So I want to give you a few tips because we're heading up to a test on Thursday. You got your essay questions in class last time. And I want to give you a few tips about reading Thermal Delight in Architecture and what you might be studying for that, for the test. It'll be exactly the same format as test number one. There will be multiple choice. There will be slide identification, 10 slides. You'll need to know the name of the architect and the name of the building, but you just have to pick it from a list. That'll be there. That's 20 points. Then there will be 10 multiple choice questions. 5 of those will be from the book. 5 of those will be from the lectures. And then there will be 2 of the essay questions that were handed out last time will be on the test. You don't get to choose which 2. I choose which 2, and you'll write them. So you should be very, very familiar with how to study and generally what's expected on that test. I did mention that the first test, I like to get everybody warmed up. So I made it a little easier. Don't expect it to be quite as easy this time. It's a little more challenging. So I just want to forewarn you of that. So let's talk about the book and what you might study for the book from the book. So there's a very kind of clear logic and order to this book. Early in the book, she talks about necessity. This is just how do plants, animals, warm-blooded animals, cold-blooded animals, how do they survive in thermally differentiated environments? And what are the natural ways that our body works to accommodate different changes in temperature? This is fundamental to understand, just like in some of the other lectures where we had a little bit of science or engineering at the beginning, and then you can kind of understand how architecture works, but you have to know the physiology of the way the body works in order to fully understand how to deal with it in a thermal environment. So you should understand that just physiology of the body. What is it about warm-blooded animals? How do they cope with heat, cold, and then how's that different from cold-blooded animals or plants or whatever? Just like that person was noticing the deciduous trees, that's the way an organism deals with heat and cold. That plant is trying to get more warmth in the wintertime too, just like we want more warmth. So they drop all their leaves and they get more warmth. That also, in the wintertime, they are basically shut down. They don't have to operate at the same way they do in the summertime. And so by losing those leaves, they have less to support. So she explains all that in the book. The second thing she does is she then begins to talk about, okay, well, what are the effects of this heat and cold? And how does that really, how do we deal with that? So she's very keen on ways that we actually enjoy the heat and the cold, like in a sauna or when you go to the beach. And she sees this as a healthy thing and something that actually physiologically is beneficial to us to experience those extremes of heat and cold. And she advocates, you know, this is not just the way our body works, but this is something we kind of crave in a certain way. Else, why would we want to do saunas, or why would we go skiing when it's bitter cold, or why would we go lay on the beach and or at Barton Springs pool and sweat like hell and then go into that cold water? And there's something kind of wonderful and natural about that. And then she talks about all of these devices that we've developed architecturally, fireplaces, gazebos, inglenooks, porch swings, all of those things that actually help us cope with how we live in heat and cold. So you need to understand the necessity, the physiology of it. You need to understand, okay, then what is good or bad about that, and how does our behavior relate to that? And then you need to understand, well, then architecturally, what have we developed to kind of express that or cope with that or deal with that? And then the final thing is you should be looking for ways that there were overlaps between the lecture material and what Lisa Hsiao-Hung talks about. So, for example, at the end of the last lecture, we were talking about passive solar houses, and she talks about passive solar houses. And in particular, we were talking about how kind of, you know, these very simple devices to try to get economy not only in initially, but economy in operation of a building, and how that can, you know, these really, really kind of dumb, simple little houses we were looking at, but that had a lot of thought put into their passive solar performance. So those are the things I'd look for in particular to study for the exam. Any questions on that? One thing, do you understand where the places are I'm asking you to look at in those essay questions? Somebody had a question on that. I answered that. But everybody know where we're talking about? Yeah? You're good? I get blank stares. Yeah. This one will. Yes. Absolutely. Okay. So now I want you to get your clickers. I want to do a little polling here. Okay. So I told you last time that this book by Lisa Hsiao-Hung, I don't necessarily expect you to agree with her. It's a pretty radical position she takes. I just want you to understand what she's saying, and I want you to think about it. So now that you've read the book, I want to ask a couple of questions. The first question is, do you think she's got a valid argument here? Do you think she makes a good point? And the first response would be, absolutely. This is really, really valid, interesting, important point that she's making. Number two is, well, I'm kind of 75% with the point that she makes, but, you know, I think about 25% of it is bogus. And the third option is, I'm sort of halfway there, 50%. Of what she says makes sense to me. 50% I think is bogus. And the fourth option is I think she's full of baloney. I totally don't agree. I want my air-conditioned house. I want my air-conditioned car. I want my air-conditioned office. And we'll figure out a way to pay for it. And we'll figure out a way to get the fuel for it. And I don't want to be hot. I don't want to be cold. Okay, so those are the four options. So vote. Option one. Absolutely agree. Option four, she's full of baloney. Okay, let's see how it came out. So 46% absolutely agree. 39% think, yeah, 75% she's got really good points. 11%, 50% agreement, and 3% thought she was full of maybe even something more extreme than baloney. I don't know. Okay, so I've got another clicker question. This one is a little more introspective. So We've got, what, a total of 85% of you? 85% of the class thinks there's something really valid about what she's talking about. Now, my question is that going to change your behavior one bit? Are you going to read that book and say, well, that was interesting, whatever, goes in the circular file and out of my mind after the quiz? Or would this actually impact your behavior? Part of what we got from those Twitter card responses last time was, some of this is just behavior-based. So, a hurricane comes and it knocks out your AC system, and you say, wow, I could actually open the windows, I could adjust the blinds, I could keep the sun out, I could get the breeze. I don't have to have air conditioning all the time. And so maybe you could say, definitely if it's 105 degrees outside, I'm turning on the AC. But all these days in the fall and in the spring, when it's like, high of 85 and a low of 60, I just could open the windows and then I could use my blinds to, mini blinds to keep the sun out and let the breeze in. I could do this just like we did when, the hurricane hit and we managed just fine. But I could do that all the time and I could save a lot of energy. Or you could say, I'm going to really look for an apartment next semester where I don't have west-facing windows because it's ridiculous. West-facing windows are stupid. And I am not going to have a bedroom that faces west that I have to pump all that AC into and keep my blinds shut all the time. It's just ridiculous. I'm not doing that. These would be behavior changes that came in response maybe to what Lisa Hsiung is saying. Maybe it's even, a behavior change that would say, instead of being so paranoid about sweating, I'm just going to, dress really practically and ride my bicycle to the university. And so I'm a little sweaty when I get there. It feels good. It's fine. It's healthy. I'm good with that. I don't have to be, perfectly sweat-free all the time. All of these would be potential responses. So I want to know, will reading this book affect at all your behavior? So the first option is to say, absolutely, this is going to affect my behavior. And I'm going to make some changes. I may not know exactly what that is, but I'm going to think about this and I'm going to change some things about the way I make choices about physical environments, about the way I use physical environments. I'm going to make some changes, absolutely. That's the first one. Would you pay attention to solar orientation? Would you pay attention to where windows are in the house and what orientation they have? Would you pay attention to whether there's solar shading in the house? Would you pay attention to what kind of insulation it has, what kind of thermal mass it has, any of those other kinds of issues? Are these going to be relevant to you? So the Twitter card question is, sort of the first option is, I am absolutely going to pay attention. This is a top priority for me. This is going to be important. The second option is, well, it's going to be important, but there are a lot of other things that are important to me, and this is going to be one of many. And, you know, maybe you say, maybe the first one is, this one is like at a, this is a top 10 item. It's going to be, you know, and the second one is sort of, no, it's somewhere below there. And the third one is, it's not going to be a consideration at all. So on this one, it's a Twitter card question, so I want to know a little bit why. Okay, it's a top priority for me because blah, blah, blah. Or I don't freaking care because I just want a badass, good-looking building that's going to impress all my friends. And I don't care what its thermal performance is. I'll just pay the bills. Okay, so that's your Twitter card question. Okay, that brings us to the topic for today, which is a synthesis of all of these issues of physical considerations. Just as we looked at the synthesis lecture on form earlier in the semester, we're going to kind of go through these multiple issues we've dealt with and look at a single building and say, okay, how does it deal with relationship to the land? How does it deal with geography, topography, ecology? How does it deal with structure and materials? How does it deal with climate? How are these things synthesized? How do they then become a total package of issues that affect the building? Because in the end, it's not about it just performing in one little way. If it's really going to be a sophisticated building in terms of physical considerations, it's got to take all these things into account. And how do you make all of those work together to make a building? And then what kind of architecture does that produce? When you really think of physical considerations seriously, what kind of building does that produce? So we're going to look at a couple of buildings. Maybe we'll get to a third one. I think we'll get to three today. And just look at it comprehensively. How do they behave as regards these issues we've looked at in physical considerations? And the first one we're going to look at is a winery in the Napa Valley in California. This one, it turns out, is a very, very shishy winery. It's Dominus Winery. Dominus is a French label, and they are an old, old, old French vintner. They were always one of the top French vintners. They always won all the big wine contests, and they were kind of the best in their field. And then it turned out that as they would have these international wine competitions, they kept getting their ass whipped by these California wines, and that was totally pissing them off. And what they realized is that they could not compete with the weather and the soil and the climate of the Napa Valley. They simply couldn't raise the grapes in France that would compete with the grapes that could be raised in the Napa Valley in California. Now, that is a big confession for a French vintner to make, that we just can't do in France what they can do in California. So Dominus Winery buys a piece of land in the Napa Valley in order to grow a particular kind of grape, in order to make a particular kind of wine, so they could whip the California vintner's ass in competitions in the future. And that actually has come to fruition. They have, in fact, done that. But they realized that to make just the kind of wine they wanted to make, they had to have just the right physical conditions, the right soil, the right climate, the right amount of sunshine, the right soil saturation in terms of moisture, the right cycles of rain. All of those things had to be just right, and Napa Valley was the place. So they buy this very, very precious piece of land. Now, the cool thing to me, I actually visited the winery with Jacques Herzog and Pierre Desmarons, the architects. They're Swiss architects. who were hired by this French vintner to come over and do this building in California. And their client, Christian Mouet, who owns Dominus Winery, was there as well. And it was really amazing to hear the architects talk about the building, but also to hear the client talk about the building. And this is a guy who, as far as he's concerned, agriculture is about, it's an art. It's about making poetry. What he makes with his wine is this beautiful, exquisite thing. And he does it by using physical considerations. He does it by understanding the soil and the climate and the light and temperature while it's being fermented. All of those things are absolutely critical in him making this beautiful artistic thing, this wine. And what he wanted from his architects was exactly the same thing. He thought the most exquisite architecture, as the most exquisite wine, is a product of understanding those physical factors, those things about soil and light and sun and heat and cool and, you know, thermal stability and all of those issues. So he came to the whole situation saying, I want you to make architecture like I make wine. I want you to make it artistically. I want you to make it exquisite. But I know that the way to do that is to use these physical considerations. So here was this wonderful confluence of a set, an agenda by the client and Herzog and Nimroner, architects who are inclined to do that anyway. They do it on all their buildings. This is a high priority in terms of their values, things we talked about early in the semester. So the site is in a valley, the Napa Valley. The valley is between two rows of hills. And those hills in this particular part of the valley, they run east-west. A rank of hills in the north running east-west, a rank of hills in the south running east-west. And in the valley between those hills is the Napa River. And the Napa River runs parallel to both of those sets of hills. And the site they had was on one side of the Napa River in this valley. And the whole valley is filled with vineyards, and all of the vines, the grapes are grown in rows, and they grow them in rows so that the south sun can hit them, so all the rows are running east-west, and with the gap between the rows, allowing the south sun to give full sun to each grape vine as it grows on its armature there. So all of that pre-existed, this pattern of the river, the hills, the east-west orientation, and so now they're figuring out how to put a building in this. And they had already started growing the vines when they built the building, because it takes a long time for one of these plants to mature to the point that they can yield grapes that will make wine. So they planted the vineyard first, and then a few years later they came in and they placed the building there. And Herzog and Demeron placed the building long and thin, extremely long and thin, with long faces north and south and short faces east and west. And this, of course, was perfect for the valley where everything ran east-west. And it just lays in there as naturally as possible. It's parallel to the hills, which you can see behind. It's parallel to the river, which is right behind us, where I'm taking this photograph. And it fits as naturally into that landscape as those rows of plants do. And it's parallel to those rows of plants. And there's this beautiful confluence of the land and the building. Now, in addition to that, they actually made the building out of stones that they had collected from the area. The stones are the same color as the soil. The stones are then gathered to make gabions, which we'll look at in a minute. But so the color of the building is very compatible with the color of the soil. And the way they're laid up in the building creates a texture that's very compatible with the texture of the hill behind. And truthfully, although this is an industrial building, and this is not a fancy pants winery where you go and have tasting and, you know, eat Italian food and stuff like that. It's not that kind of bullshit winery. This is a serious winery. They're making wine here. They don't even allow visitors to come in. So the building is huge, and it's an industrial building, but it sits very innocuously in the landscape. When you drive by on the highway, I drove by this about 3 times and couldn't see the building. And then finally, there it is. So it sits very, very innocuously in the landscape. It blends into the landscape. Now, it's made, I said, of these gabions. Gabions are these wire cages. And wire is the armature that holds up all these vines. So you see all that in the vineyards, which were there before. And then they took the rocks from the soil, and they took the wire, as you see in the vineyards, and they made these gabion cages and filled them with rocks. And that essentially is the texture of the exterior of the building. But all of this is just to make the point that in terms of that first lecture, buildings and the land, how does a building relate to its landscape? This building comes very thoroughly, very naturally out of the gross configuration of the valley, out of the micro configuration of the vines around it, and all the way down to material selection being compatible with the vineyards. Okay, that was that first lecture. Then we had a lecture on geography, topography, ecology. We were talking about these horrible problems in Southeast Houston when they didn't think about impervious cover, and they didn't think about rainfall, and about extremes of rainfall, and about erosion, and about, you know, evacuation of water, and all those kinds of things. So in this case, they're absolutely thinking about those, and they're shaping the building. So for one thing here, we're talking about extremely precious soil. They prayed a freaking fortune for this dirt because it's exactly the right dirt to grow beautiful grapes to make beautiful wine. So you're not going to go around screwing up the ecology of this area. That's why they're here, is for that ecology. So the building makes an absolutely minimal impact on the ecology of the site. As you can see, there's just almost no impervious cover. The building footprint itself is impervious cover. There is a very small, like one lane wide, concrete road that gets trucks in and out of this industrial facility. But other than that, there's no impervious cover. It's just dirt. And that is to allow this maximum natural ecology of that region. The other thing is that you might worry about is, let's say, erosion. So say we had a gutter and a downspout coming down, and we were dumping the water onto that dirt, and that might create a little rivulet and some kind of erosion. You absolutely don't want that here. This is the most manicured dirt I've ever seen in my life. It's precious. They understand that. So the way they dealt with the water off the roof is that it actually does go into gutters on the edges, and then it drops into these gabion cages, which are just kind of outside the waterproof barrier of the building. And as the water drops down, it hits all these rocks, and it gets all dispersed, and it turns into this very fine mist, and then it falls into that dirt as a very fine mist. So it's keeping the water there, retaining it, no sending the water downstream. They've created it into a mist, and then allowing it very gently to seep into the soil on the perimeter of the building. One of the most clever, interesting ways of just dealing with water coming off of a building I've ever seen, but very responsive to the condition here. They're also very interested in the ecology of the wildlife here. They understand that when you're growing grapes, you begin to have snakes and mice and other little critters that like to eat those grapes, and that those critters would probably like to nest in these gabions. So they put a finer mesh at the bottom down here so that the critters can't get into the gabions, and then a wider mesh up here that's just big enough to hold the rocks in. And I was in Herzog and Dimeron's office in Basel in Switzerland shortly after the building was done, and they still had a mock-up that they had done there to try to figure out how dense the mesh needed to be. And they said what they did was they went down to the pet store and they bought a snake and they bought a mouse. And they put the mesh between the snake and the mouse, and they went home at night. And the next morning, if the snake had eaten the mouse, then the mesh wasn't tight enough, and they needed a tighter mesh. So they'd get the next tighter mesh, get a snake and a mouse, and see how it worked, until they got one that both snake and mouse were healthy the next morning, and that was good enough. That's what we call the empirical method of making those kind of decisions. Okay, so we've thought about buildings in the land. We've thought about geography, topography, ecology. Another big issue they're dealing with here is structure and materials, and this building is extremely explicit about structure and materials. We can see that part of it is bearing walls, big concrete bearing walls, concrete, of course, a material that's excellent in compression, just big, long bearing walls. And actually, often they're behind those gabions. There are big concrete walls, and inside that are just big vats that are used to process the wine, or they're big barrels where the wine is stored to ferment. And so they're not spaces that need any windows or any access. They're just big storage spaces. So large parts of the building just have bearing walls. But then there are other parts where they need to drive trucks in, or where their offices are, that they've got a frame structure or a bending structure. And that, of course, is made out of steel, because steel's really good in bending. And you can look up and see through this little mesh, and you can see all the steel framing up there. So all of the structure, both bearing walls and bending frame, are all dealt with very, very explicitly. And upstairs, see where you have the offices for the operation, and you want to be able to get views out, and you want to be able to get breezes in, then the frame is much more appropriate. But down here is actually an area full of kegs of wine. You don't really want any openings in that, so the bearing wall is much more appropriate there. So function is in some ways driving what structural system is appropriate where. So you see at this end of it where those big vats are, we get a concrete bearing wall all the way around with the gabions on the outside, and that's just perfect. Bearing wall, then where we need the offices to open up, then we get that bending structure made out of steel. It lets the light and the air and the view in, and that makes a very appropriate response to it. And then in the middle, there is the sally port where the trucks come in and get loaded and unloaded, and that again has to open up and have the bending structure there as well. So every material you look at, every treatment, it makes perfect sense in terms of being a part of a larger system. And where we have glass walls that want lots and lots of visibility, their offices inside here, they're made just totally of glass that spans from the top to the bottom. Gives tremendous visibility. You feel like you're right in the middle of the vineyard. Also gives very, very good light. And the overhang, of course, means the light is good, soft light. Every material through the whole process is chosen very sensibly. What is the performance I need here, and what is the right kind of material to do that? You can see that even in the handrail. So I have this wire mesh down here. That means nothing falls over, because it is an industrial place. But then the place where the hand touches, that's wood, and it feels a little more friendly to you than the roughness or the crudeness of wire mesh would have done. Okay, so we've talked about buildings on the land, geography, topography, ecology, structure, materials, every piece and part that goes in there, how it's logically responsive to the demands of it. And then the final lecture we had was on climate and energy. And this is a building that is exquisite in terms of its climate performance, better than exquisite. It's almost perfect. Now, it is long and thin, as I said. Long faces north and south, short faces east and west. That's perfect climatically, as well as being very sympathetic to the site and the land. And all of the fenestration is either on the north side or the south side. There's absolutely no fenestration on the east or the west ends, those little narrow ends. Where there is fenestration or some kind of opening, there is solar shading here on the south side. On the north side, of course, there's no need for solar shading, so there's nothing there. allowing the light to come in the wintertime and to keep the light out in the summertime. Now, as I said, there also are these big areas that are just for the vats. And the big thing they want there is thermal stability. What you want for the wine to ferment perfectly is for it to stay at the same temperature. And Herzog and Demeron tried to convince Christian Mue that we are putting no mechanical systems in these buildings at all. We will just let the architecture keep the temperature stable. And they said, totally, we can do this. And Christian Mue said, oh, but see, even if it fluctuates maybe 5 degrees at the wrong time, it can screw up my wine, and it's ruined, and I can't fix it at that point. So no, this is too delicate. It's too vulnerable. I need mechanical systems. And they went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, they said, okay, well, we'll put in the mechanical systems, but we're going to do everything we can possibly do in a passive sense to never have to use those mechanical systems. And you'll only have to turn them on when the passive systems, for some reason, fail. So let's say we had record-setting heat for 2 weeks. Okay, maybe at that point you'll have to turn on the air conditioner. But when I was there, they'd been in operation for a year, and they had never turned on any air conditioning or any heating. So that it had just, the building had taken care of making that temperature stable. And this is an area where in the Napa Valley they have a high diurnal swing, meaning that it often is very cool at night, 50 degrees, maybe even 40 degrees sometimes. And it can be pretty warm during the day, not 105 like we have, but it can get to be 95. But they often, in the same day, it might be 50 or 60 degrees at night and 90 degrees during the day. So what you need is something to dampen that diurnal swing that will be high thermal mass. The sun will shine on it during the day. It'll warm it up. And then at night, when it gets cold outside, that heat will re-radiate back into the building and keep it stable thermally. So that's what they were using here. And in order to get that thermal stability, they're getting maximum thermal mass. So they got those big, thick concrete walls. And then on the outside of that, they've got these big gabions full of stone. So they have massive amounts of thermal mass, the concrete and the stone, all trying to keep those vats inside there just as stable thermally as they possibly can. And that works remarkably well. And then for the more inhabited spaces, then they don't want that quite that same thermal mass. They want to be able to get the cooling breezes. They want to be able to get the direct sunlight. And so in those areas, it's very different. So some areas are very solid and massive, and those are the storage areas for the wine. Some areas are very open and light, and that's where the people work. And that's what it looks like inside those storage areas with the massive concrete walls with the stone on the outside maintaining that thermal stability. Now, sometimes there's just absolute magic that comes out of this system, too. Those gabions, which are a very cheap, very inexpensive material, they give you that high thermal mass. That's fantastic. They also actually give you breeze that can go through in those holes between the rocks so that when you're there, it's cool because it's shady. The high thermal mass keeps it cool. And as that breeze comes through, it's cooled by the high thermal mass of those rocks. And it's incredibly pleasant breeze on the inside. The day I was there, when the sun set, the sun would get low in the sky in the west, very short west face there. It's all made out of gabions. There's no opening on that west face. But there are these little bits of light that you kind of see through the gaps in the rocks. And then there's a glass wall inside, and there's a corridor between. And those little pricks of light, when the sun went right down at the horizon, and it's going straight into the building, and it was making little reflections of light on the glass. But it was doing it just like an eclipse. You know, when there's an eclipse of the sun and you put a pinprick and the reflection through that is not a circle, it's a little moon shape. It was doing that because all of the light coming through there was being eclipsed by the sun as it went below the hills. And it was just It was like a magical moment, like, wow, this is really beautiful. Again, it came out of physical considerations, just dealing with temperature and light and air movement, creating this kind of solution. Now, likewise, there was there. We had a tour in the morning. In the afternoon, we had some business to transact, so we had a meeting that was right there. And the conference room is not an indoor room. The conference room is right out there in the open space. You had beautiful views of the vineyards out there. We had lunch sitting out there and then this meeting. And you're thinking, dude, why don't we work like this more? Why aren't there more operations that are so in sync with nature and light and views and greenery and all of that so that it just feels like such a healthy work environment? It's heavenly to work in a place like that. Compare that to some damn cube smashed inside some building with no natural light. And why in the world would we as human beings put ourselves in the position of that kind of separation from nature, from physical considerations, from all those things we've been talking about? This seems to me an exquisite rethinking of how you work in an environment. And it was really, really a great place to work. So they did have offices, and on a cold day, of course, they could work in their office. But they also had these outdoor rooms where they could actually do their work sometimes, especially like a meeting outside. Okay, very thorough dealing with all of these issues of physical considerations. At the level of, honestly, just kind of an industrial building in the Napa Valley in California, not a terribly expensive building. We're not talking about a fancy pants museum here. We're just talking about an industrial building, but beautifully done. Okay, second example is the Simpson Lee House in Mount Wilson, Australia. It's about maybe 115, 20 miles to the west of Sydney. The architect is Glenn Murcutt, and it was completed in the middle 1990s. This one, again, is one of those buildings that takes physical considerations very seriously. Glenn Murcutt is a sustainable architect. He's probably maybe the poster child for a sustainable architect in the entire world. This is someone whose reputation and career has been built on reactions to physical considerations. So he's on a site, and it's a very, very natural site. This one is on a hillside. The client is an economist, Dr. Lee. And Dr. Lee is a very famous economist. He teaches at University of Sydney. And what he does in terms of economics is he believes in resource conservation. So he is saying that the world's economies could be way, way, way stronger if we practice more resource conservation. So when he then retired at an early age from University of Sydney and wanted to make a place where he could do his writing and research in solitude and quiet, he bought this piece of land in Mount Wilson, and he told Glenn Murcutt, I want a house that's about resource conservation. I want a house that's not going to burn fossil fuel. I don't want a heating and cooling system in my house. I want the house to do that for me. I want a house that in every way is sustainable. So that's what the challenge was to Glenn Murcutt. Now, it is out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing but a dirt road that goes out to this. And the idea was that he would, you know, just live with his wife out there and write his books and live in a very, in a way, primitive, natural way. So the slope of the land is rather steep on his whole site, and it's all going down to a watershed down here. There are big rock outcroppings uphill right there. And so Glenn Murcutt decided to slide the house parallel to the contours, long and thin, long faces north and south, short faces east and west, and parallel to the contours of the land. So it sits just very gently in the land there. He also opened the house up completely. There are huge glass walls that just disappear into the side. So that little bay right there, there would be one, two, three panels that would all slide back and stay there. And when those three go that way and three go this way, there's a maybe 60 feet of just completely open wall. So in a way, it's like camping out. You get absolutely every breeze. You hear every bird chirping. You hear every woodchuck chucking, or in this case, more like koala chucking. Very, very natural feeling. And incredibly, incredibly peaceful. Oh, my God, just your mind just relaxes. And this is one thing that Dr. Lee wanted. He wanted a place like that where he could work. So when you're inside the house, it is very much about being outside as well. And that total communion with the land. And it sits very, very simply and gently in that land within a long view, and this would be that south face looking out into the landscape there, and with very deep overhangs on that south side. Of course, I'm saying south. We know this is in Australia. That's really north, but they're upside down. We dealt with that before. So another thing that he did was so in terms of buildings and land, it sits very gently parallel to the contours, slides in there. And then he also had sort of minimum impact. He was trying to do as little impervious cover as possible. So he puts the house up on stilts, as you can see there, so that the ground just goes right under the house. I think I had a view earlier of then the walkway even that goes up to it. We can see in the slide on the right there. That walkway is not impervious cover. It's just deck that comes from the driveway up to the house. So just as little impact in terms of impervious cover as possible. They also are collecting every bit of rainwater they can. This is an area of Australia that doesn't get a lot of rain. They're very drought prone in this area. So they're saving every bit of water they can. All of the water goes off of this sloped roof into a gutter. That gutter then takes it into tanks on the backside here where it's stored, and all of their domestic water for bathing, for cooking, for all of those things, it comes from those tanks in the backside of the house there. Then there is other kind of water they need. This is also a flood-prone area. I'm sorry, a fire-prone area. So these are all eucalyptus trees around there. Eucalyptus trees burn very, very easily, but they also need to burn. And this is something we've learned in American forests, that there are a lot of species that actually need to burn. The forests do need to burn periodically. In this case, the seed pods of a eucalyptus tree won't burst and therefore give seeds for the next generation of trees unless there's a fire. So they need, every couple of years, they need to have a fire that will burst those seed pods and will regenerate the forest. So this is in an area that is completely undeveloped. And so normally wildfires would go through there and that would be fine. Nobody's the worse off. But now Dr. Lee is inhabiting that area. And instead of saying, okay, well, you got to get the firefighters out there and protect me. So, you know, drop bombs of water from helicopters when there's a fire and protect me. Instead, Dr. Lee and Glenn Murga decided, okay, we've got to make a house that will protect itself in case of a fire. So they actually have a sprinkler system on top of the house, just like sprinklers we have inside houses. And they have a reservoir right here. So as the water comes down the hill, it goes into the reservoir right there. It stays there as a kind of reflecting pool until it's needed, and then it's tripped by a thermal switch, and then it goes up to the sprinkler system that's up here and completely inundates the house with water. And then the wildfire moves through, and the house is left perfectly protected. And they've had several wildfires burn through here, and absolutely no damage to the house. In fact, there's so much capacity in that reservoir that now they've piped the water to the neighboring house
to inundate it as well. Now, again, why haven't we figured that out in the United States? Are those Aussies that much smarter than we are?
No.
All over Colorado. You know, they have big fires and, you know, horrible devastation. Why don't we just build houses that inundate themselves with water? We should do that, yes? Okay, we should do that. We've solved the problem now. But this is just intelligent design reacting to the geography, topography, ecology of the place. The ecology demands fires. They're natural. They work. So we should build in concert with that natural requirement. Okay, so it deals with the land. It deals with geography, topography, ecology. It also is a very interesting building in terms of structure and materials. Now, probably most people, Dr. Lee comes to you and he says, I want this very natural house. I want to live with nature. I want to have minimum consumption of resources. Most of us probably would have thought, okay, maybe a wood house, right? Well, number one, we have to understand that in Australia, they have no softwoods that are native to Australia. All they have is hardwoods. We have tons of softwood in North America. Pine trees, fir, spruce, all of those that we use for construction, all your 2x4s, they're all softwoods. But they don't have any of those native to Australia. All of their trees are hardwoods. And hardwoods take a lot longer to grow than softwoods. So if you use the wood there, that's a serious depletion because it takes that tree a long, long time to grow, a lot more than if it were a pine tree. So Glenn Murga says, okay, well, I'm not going to use hardwoods. I'm going to leave the native forests and not despoil them. So instead, he makes the house out of steel. And steel is actually one of the biggest industries in Australia, so it's a locally produced material. And he does it in very small pieces of steel. So I told you there's just a dirt road into this place. And so he said, okay, we're not going to have big concrete trucks come in here. We're not going to have big 18-wheelers making big deliveries into here. Everything has to be able to come in on a pickup truck so that we don't have to build a big road and so that we don't have to even cut trees around where there were overhangs over that road. So everything had to come in on a pickup truck. So they made lots of little pieces of steel, and they assembled those together to make the structure of the house. And everything could be bolted together on the site. So it's like a kit of parts that gets made at a steel manufactory in Sydney, 100 miles away, gets put on a pickup truck, it comes out here, and you assemble it. You put all those bolts and pieces together. And it just looks like that. You can see it as sort of tinker toys that all get assembled into these kind of tree-like shapes, just like the eucalyptus trees around here, kind of tall, thin, delicate things, just like the trees are extremely tall, thin, delicate things there. But you see the structure very explicitly carrying all those loads, beautifully detailed. We see all the pipes that are going to feed that sprinkler system on the roof. Everything very honest, very straightforward. There even is this kind of frame. We see a complete bending system here, the frame with infill of the corrugated metal. We see even those bracing loads, the diagonal loads, being taken in tension by cables that go across there. Again, perfect use of materials for the structural role they're playing. Very explicit explanation of those in the architecture of the building. Okay, so great on buildings and land, great on geography, topography, ecology, great on structure and materials. And then finally, this whole thing of climate. Again, long faces north and south, short faces east and west, complete natural ventilation through the whole building, deep overhangs on the south that would allow the sun to come in the wintertime but keep the sun out in the summertime. Climate there is very much like here, maybe a little colder in the winter, but it keeps the building perfectly temperate all year round. And in fact, there is no air conditioning and no heating in this building at all. It does get to be cold sometimes in the winter there, and there's a massive fireplace here. Massive in the sense of thermal mass, not massive in the sense of size. It's made out of steel.
So again, he's bringing in materials that you can get in a pickup truck, but he's getting these pieces of steel that come in and assembling them to make a fireplace. And so it's like an old iron stove where when you heat that iron up, it has very high density and very high thermal mass, and then it just radiates into the room. So this fireplace is like that, and it's in the center of the house, and they get the warmth from that. Now, they also are very frank about the fact that in the wintertime, you either are snuggled up under the comforter in the bedrooms are at each end, or you're huddled around that fireplace because that's the only source of heat. It's a bit like in Lisa Hishong's book, she talks about that Harvard professor that goes to France and has this big house, but in the wintertime, it's only heated by fireplaces, and there's no way you're keeping all those fireplaces going, so you tend to huddle in one spot. And they do the same thing here in the Simpson Lee house. The heat really is confined to a particular space in the wintertime. So this is architecture that comes almost 100% from physical considerations. Yes, there are issues of form here, and he's thinking of composition and geometry and proportion and scale and all those things, but really he's thinking so sincerely about physical considerations, and that's what's driving the house. Okay, the third and final example, this one's a little closer to home, just to show, yes, we can do this in Texas, and yes, we can do it in response to our climate. This is Rough Creek Lodge. It's a kind of retreat and conference center that's about 70 or 80 miles west of Fort Worth. So the kind of the very top of what you might stretch to call the Hill Country in Glen Rose, Texas. And this was it had been an old farm ranch site, and there had been a house that was built in the 1930s that had burned down. And so this guy who owned the ranch next door bought it because he loved this beautiful piece of land, and he had more money than anybody. I mean, he's a really, really rich guy. And so he buys this ranch next door when the farmhouse burned down and the occupants left. And he decided it was just so beautiful there, he wanted to invite his friends to come in and enjoy this. And by his friends, he meant people like him who were in business. And he felt like business people need this refresher. They need to go out to nature. They need to be resuscitated. And if you just live as a businessman all your life and you're making money, but you lose contact with nature. So his idea was to have this retreat and this conference center where businesses could say, okay, we're going to take our leadership team out here for 3 days, and everybody's going to do business and talk about business, but we're going to do it in a completely different environment where you can really be in touch with nature. So the site and nature were huge priorities for this guy as he went to his architect. So this is the site right there. There had been that big farmhouse up here. Around it, there were big deciduous trees that had been planted and nurtured around that farmhouse. So although there isn't a lot of vegetation generally on the ranch, there was a concentration of vegetation there. So that group of trees there and there and there, the buildings began to just be weaved between those trees. And the trees became really important determinants of where the buildings were sitting. So it's at the top of a hill. The decision was made not to put another building on the top of the hill, but to make the buildings kind of go just below the prow of the hill so that they didn't dominate, but they just kind of hugged the shape of the landscape. And you can see how those contours wrap around there, and the buildings just took exactly the shape of the contours there. That would be the top of the hill. They're just below the prow of the hill and nestled in among these trees that are right there. So again, most of them, you see all the way along there, that's the north arrow. Long faces north and south. Short faces east and west. This is just the pool complex, and that's just the kind of hunting, where you get your hunting gear. But the bulk of the buildings are just along that long face looking down the hill.
And then there's beautiful views out to the hills around. There's a lake that's at the bottom. So the views are out to the north, allowing nice north light, but also with the lake out there. There also are huge winds in this area. So on the south side, where you're trying to get some areas that you might be out in the wintertime when it might be cold here, so there actually is a retaining wall and a kind of sunken court here on the south side. So the sun comes in there, but it's protected from the wind, from the north wind by the buildings, and you get this kind of warmer south court for the summertime, and then big courts to the north, for the wintertime, and then big courts to the north for the summertime. Pretty much every room here has an extension outdoors. Porches are very common. Here's a fire pit for sitting around on a winter evening. So very much about being outdoors and being connected to nature around. So very solid orientation to buildings and the land. In terms of geography, topography, ecology, it's being, you know, the slope is down to the lake down below. Everything is concentrated in this one area, and so that, again, it doesn't despoil the topography of the place. In terms of structure and materials, there are stone walls that go all the way through the site, and they're made of this high thermal mass, local limestone, and very solid. There are piers on part of it where there actually is stone that's made as formwork, and then the concrete is poured in the cavity of the little stone pier, and then the concrete is oozes out at the top and is finished off. Then they do another lift of stone walls around with concrete inside, and it comes out, and another lift of that, and that becomes the piers that carry those lateral loads from the curved roof down into that, slowly getting thicker and thicker as it goes into the ground. So again, bearing system, compression loads, the size of the piece, the materials it's made out of, a complete reflection of the loads that are moving through it. That in stark contrast to this area, which is an open walkway made out of bending members, out of steel, very light, very delicate, very open. The stairwells here, particularly thin, delicate pieces. The handrails, very delicate, so you don't get any obstruction to the view. The steel is super strong and can be kept very thin. Even the handrails here actually are tension members, so they're bringing just like a wire, so they're keeping you from falling off, but at the same time not obstructing your view. Again, the material being suited to exactly what its loads and performance are. Inside, the same kind of bending system, now made out of wood. And you can see all of those joints and intersections of the wood so that, again, you see it just laid up like tinker toys. The big distinction between the bending system here and a bearing system there in the fireplace, where you see the kind of massiveness of the stone and the contrast between the stone and the kind of character it has and the wood and the kind of character it has. There are all of those in bending. When you get something in tension in these trusses, then it turns into just a cable and steel, and you see all those intricate joints and connections that explain to you exactly the loads moving through the building. All of them pretty much in bending, a few in tension, and using the materials that are appropriate for bending, wood, and then where they need tension, then they use the steel. The south porch facing here and that warmer south patio, the north porch facing here to those long views and the water beyond, creating a microclimate all the way around the building, this zone that is more temperate. And that would even be true in the wintertime here, where the sun shines there, the high thermal mass of those piers, the sun penetrating when it's low in the sky and collecting heat next to the building so you don't have to heat against 30 degrees outside but maybe just 50 degrees on the porch. The same thing in the summertime here, that creating a microclimate there so it never gets 105 degrees like it is here, but it's maybe just 95 degrees there, and your air conditioning against that. The bottom line of that, I mean, it's all about physical consideration, and it's all about connecting to nature and big openings onto nature, but sun protection so you don't get the heat or the glare of the Texas sun, allowing you to see nature, to connect with it, to go indoors and outdoors, big patios, big eating terraces, all of those kinds of things, but at the same time, being very practical in the larger context of that climate and that landscape. So all of these are buildings that are particularly attuned to physical considerations. And we've been talking about all these physical considerations. There are others that we didn't have time to get to this semester, things like acoustics. This is a building that is 100% about acoustics. It's got an elevated train in Chicago that runs right straight through there, and the whole shape and form and character of the building is about controlling acoustics. So there are many, many ways in which these physical considerations can inspire the character of the architecture. Okay, that's it for today. Do your Twitter card question, and good luck on the test on Thursday.
Good question. Do you want us to come up with the slides again for the test?
Yeah, the